Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Rick D. from the Holy Family College, right down the book group about AA in Philadelphia.
Good evening, guys. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be alive and a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous, contrary to how I was and where I'd been and to where this power has taken me to. Right here, right now, tonight here with you guys. I have a home group. My home group is Holy Family College, and we meet in Philadelphia on Friday nights at 7 o'clock. And if you're ever in the area, please come in and visit. And it's a big book study. We break down one sentence at a time, and we discuss it, and it's pretty cool. It's funny, we can read a paragraph and 20 hands will go up and you'll hear 20 different experiences on that paragraph. And we learn the book real quick that way. And it takes us about 75 weeks to go through the first 164 pages. I'm also involved with another group. We meet on Wednesday nights. And that's also a big book meeting, but it's a step meeting out of the big book. And we usually go through a step a night, and I do that with my friend Murray. And it's a lot of new people. It's for a bunch of recovery houses in Philadelphia. And it's constant new people. And it's a beautiful thing to be part of. And that is a bright spot in my life. I have a sponsor. And he has a sponsor. And he took me through the steps. And I take other guys through the steps. And they take guys through the steps. And with that, there is a fellowship of the Spirit that grows up in and about me, and I'm not in the middle of it. I'm just a small part of it, and that is also has been a bright spot in my life. Meeting these new guys and like coming up here, driving with a bunch of my friends. It's funny stuff. Like these road trips are, it's fun. We just laugh a lot. It's amazing how we go through these steps and we have this spiritual awakening, and our conversations change. It's not about sex. It's not about the girls. It's about making amends. It's about a new guy, what recovery house. It's about what meeting we're going to this weekend. And I'd like to thank Billy for driving up here and the guys I came up with. They are, like I said, a bright spot in my life. And through the 12th step of sponsorship, I've learned how to love. I've learned how to love other men. So I learned how to bond with other men in that process. God separated me from alcohol, and I say separated because it was not my plan. I did not design it. I did not plan it. On November 29th of 2005, it was purely out of selfish and self-seeking reasons. It was November. It was snowing in Philadelphia that day, and I had no energy. I was going to do two things. I was either going to throw myself in front of the next bus that runs down Roosevelt Boulevard, or I was going to make a phone call to my friend Vic. And I had no energy to throw myself in front of that bus. And I had 50 cents in my pocket, and I called my friend Vic, who I knew had a property around the corner from his house, and he was thinking about making it into a recovery house. He told me to go into this house, and I had to walk. If anybody knows Philadelphia, I had to walk from Red Line to Boulevard to Princeton and State Road. I don't know if anybody knows Philadelphia. It's not a hop, skip, and a jump. And I said, well, how am I supposed to get there? And he said, walk. And I did that. And all I really wanted was a change of clothes, a cheesesteak, and a hot shower. And instead, what I got was... I got a sponsor and a big book and oodles and noodles for the next 3 weeks. And so God was answering my prayers. Because if I was going to pray that day, my prayer would have been something like this. God, just how about if you let me drink for 2 years the way I did when I was 21? And after that, you can just take me. In the summer of 2005, I came to while I was drinking one day. And And I found myself drinking for an entirely different reason. I found myself drinking for the courage to kill myself. I don't know if anybody else has been in that spot. It's a dark, it's lonely spot. And as I sat there wondering how I'm going to do this, I look back today. There's a few reasons why. One, because I was totally alone, had no one to turn to any longer. And the biggest reason was the one thing that lit me up and allowed me to come out and play and fit in with you guys and fit in with this world, it no longer worked. And that was drinking. And I sat there because I've entered a stage of alcohols and that was bleak. There was no more fun in it at all. I'm trying to jumpstart a party and there's no party in it. And I sat there because I'm a lot older than some people here, but I could see how this drinking might go on for many more years. And that ain't going to happen. And what I did was I tied a Timberland shoelace around my neck, and I hung myself in my parents' bathroom, and got a, can't even do that right, and got other plans for me. I came to in Frank Victorzo Hospital in Philadelphia, with two members of AA standing over top of me as I was handcuffed to the bed because I was getting 302 as soon as they stitched my face up. And my friend Danny leaned over me and says, "Rick, are you ready to go through the steps yet?" And that was a tough question. I didn't know. And he said, "What you'll get is a quiet mind and a loving heart." And when do I get laid? When's that? Where's that step? How about when do I get a motorcycle? Is there a step for that? And usually when I go into a, when I share my experience with, I go into a meeting, or I go into a rehab, or I go into detox, I share my experience with guys, and usually one person always says, "Well, why didn't you just go to AA, or NA, or CA, or somewhere?" And the truth of the matter is, that morning that I hung myself, I had over a year of continuous sobriety. I had a year of no mood or mind-altering substances in me, and it was horrible. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. With no sponsor, my thoughts were unattended, unchecked, unaccountable for, and that year was miserable. I found on page 151 and 152, it talks about the jumping-off place. I was there because the alcohol no longer worked, and being sober was almost as painful as drinking. With a racing head, after I got 302 to Friends Hospital, that set off a lot of chain of events that brings me here tonight. And what happened? It took a lot of misery, it took a lot of pain, it took a lot of dis-ease and discomfort, it took a lot of hurt family members and resentful friends. It took an uncooperative PO and an angry judge. And it took a little bit of bloodshed and a lot of detoxes, rehabs, and psych wards. And that all came after having a year and a half of continual sobriety with no sponsor, no steps, no spiritual awakening, no nothing. And after the dust settled, I found myself living in this recovery house. My first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting was in 1999. I wasn't new to AA in 2005. And in this recovery house, I met the cream of the crop of Alcoholics Anonymous. I met men and women who were God-centered. I met men and women who were God-conscious and God-directed enough to actually sit down and open the book up with me and take me through these steps. They actually told me what the disease of alcoholism was. And after every one of those relapses, from August to November, every one of my ideas of what I thought AA was beat out of me. That if I just had the right girl, if my parents would just love me right, if I had the job, if I had all the externals, I'd be okay. And they said, "Rick, did you ever drink? Did you ever drink when you didn't want to?" And I said, "Yeah." "Did you ever drink when you had a girlfriend?" I said, "Yeah." "Did you ever drink when you didn't have a girlfriend?" I said, "Yeah." "Did you ever drink when the Eagles lost?" I said, "Yeah." "Did you ever drink when the Eagles won?" "Yeah." So it has nothing to do with my outside circumstances, although my ego would love to tell me that. And they sat me down and they took me through these steps. And it made a lot of sense to me. They explained that the disease of alcoholism. I did not drink, or my alcoholism was not caused by my excessive drinking, or my excessive, and as part of my story, I did use a lot of non-AA approved substances, and I did not drink and do drugs obsessively, because I drank my way into that. I drank excessively and obsessively because of the alcoholism I had long before I took my first drink, and that was news to me. I thought that, if I stopped drinking, I would be okay, and that was a lie. And as we went through this book, I just heard Sandy Beach give a great analogy of our book. He says, the big book's like a treasure map, and the sponsor's like a guide, and the treasure is a spiritual awakening. And that made a lot of sense to me, because these guys, these men and women, it just wasn't, my sponsor said, I need more than one person. He said, you need handlers. And what happened was, at the very beginning of this recovery house, I sat there, and there was just a stream of people coming to this house with a book. And after about the third day of this, I give up. Okay, what do I got to do? What do I got to do? Because these dudes were just coming one after another. These big roofing-looking dudes, and these mechanic-looking dudes, and these accounting dudes. And they sat with me and gave up their time. And my friend Danny shook my hand. He said, "We're going to make a deal." He said, "I'm going to take you through these steps, not to make your life better, so you can actually go through these steps and take somebody else through the steps and make their life better." And I get why them guys came to that recovery house looking for me. And explained a lot of things I couldn't explain. From the very first time I drank, I was down the shore in Wildwood, and we're under the boardwalk. And my 19-year-old cousin, it was her turn to babysit us. And she said, "Rick, tonight you're going to drink. Because if you drink, you can't rat us out." I said, "Okay, whatever." And I never even seen a drunk person before. I was warned about drinking and doing drugs. And we didn't have 40s back then. We had quarts. And so we're under the boardwalk, and the quart bottle comes my way. I take a few pops off of that quart bottle, and a couple more pops, and a couple more pops. And I guess I drank about a quart. And I went back up on that boardwalk, and it was a different experience. The lights got brighter. That big wooden roller coaster I was scared to go on, I went on it twice. The pizza, Max Pizza, tasted a whole lot better. Right? And one big thing, I could talk to girls. I could actually, the one thing that I was, at 14 years old, the only problem that I had, I couldn't talk to girls. I stuttered a lot. I weighed about 90 pounds soaking wet. I had long, greasy hair, and a big giant nose and skinny little legs, and I wasn't worthy of talking to any females. And when I drank, they were lucky to know me. Right? No longer scared. Right? And from the very first time I drank, I felt like I wanted more. So the phenomenon of craving was present in me. Long before I took my first drink, it was in me. Alcoholism was present in me. All I had to do was pour alcohol on it to ignite it. And I didn't drink. At 14 years old, I didn't drink every day. I had a thing at home that was cunning, baffling, and powerful. It was called Mom and Dad. And they watched me like a hawk. I played a lot of sports. And the only time I felt free, the only two times I felt free was either playing hockey and baseball or when I was drinking. And I can go back as far as, I don't remember why I remember this. I can go back as far as kindergarten. Why I can remember this, and I don't remember the 80s or 90s. My mom said, we woke up one morning and she said, "We're going to go to school today." Yeah. Okay. And as we walked through the back alleyways of Wishnomi in Philadelphia, I experienced a lot of anxiety. I didn't know what this meant. And as I walked up to this kindergarten class, there was kids already playing, already interacting. And I was scared to death. And my mom says, you're going to meet a lot of new friends, and you're going to have fun. And what a lie that was. School was a horrible experience for me. I couldn't be present. I don't know if anybody else is like me. I'm in school, and I'm watching that clock. I can't wait for recess. I can't wait for lunch. I couldn't wait for 3 o'clock to get out. And pretty much how I lived my whole life was around April, all through school, around April, I would start experiencing a lot of anxiety. I could not wait for the first day of summer. And then when the last day of school came, it was the best day. But the first day of summer, I'm already in my head about the next school year. That this teacher's going to give me a lot of homework, and I'm not going to be able to pass, and I'm not going to know nobody in the grade, and they're going to pick on me. And the whole summer was ruined already in June. And I experienced a lot of anxiety from that fear. And the one thing that, I don't know who invented this, but I'm sure it's helping a lot of psychiatrists with square dancing in school. That I remember we had to go square dancing, and the girls had to pick the partner, and that was, we'll talk about anxiety. If I could jump out the window, I would have. And they explained to me, like, Beck, this phenomenon of craving that once I start, I can't stop. It made a lot of sense because I can look back, back in the 80s, we had a marriage epidemic in my neighborhood. I hung out with a ton of people. Our corporate ladder was the back alleyway to the playground, to the schoolyard, to the bar. That was our corporate ladder. And I hung out with a huge crowd. And it seemed like every month, one of my friends was getting married. And what would happen, we would go to the rehearsal dinner, because I would be asked to be in the wedding. And I would go to the rehearsal dinner on Thursday night and start drinking. And come Saturday, where's Rick? And there wasn't cell phones back then. And they would just, they go door to door searching for me. They usually find me crawled up in somebody's basement. And it was like, first I was asked to be in weddings, to be the best man. Then I was just asked to be part of the bridal party. Then it was, can you come to our wedding? Can you drive in our wedding? And then I wasn't even invited after a few months because they were watching me. I used to go to weddings, and guys would say, Rick, behave. Just behave tonight. And I didn't miss their weddings because I didn't love them. It's because once I started to drink, I had to finish that off. And nothing came before that. I drank all through high school, and it was just what we did. It was just what we did, and I didn't know that, I never had a plan when I'm 16 years old to land in AA when I'm 42 years old. This wasn't part of the plan. I never thought that I would be one of those people. As we went through this first 3 steps, I was taken through the steps very quickly and thoroughly. Quickly and thoroughly. These guys spent a lot of time with me. And the second step, as I went through that second step, now I was in AA for 6 years before I went through the steps. And I thought I was the yeah, I know guy and the yeah, but guy. And as I went through the second step, I thought I had to be clean and good and full of faith in order to take that second step. And it was just the opposite. My friend Danny, my friend Chris, has said, Rick, are you willing to believe in the power greater than yourself? And I said, well, I don't know about the spirituality. Me and Rob were just talking about this. And just know that, he said, just know there's a God and it's not you. I said, I can do that. It's not me. Okay. Because I was raised, how I was raised, and a lot of my childhood memories are from down the shore. And I remember, you ever see when a little kid is anxious and he runs to the corner and he waits for his parents to catch up, and then then his parents walk, but the kid runs to the next corner and he waits? And that's what I used to do to go under the boardwalk. And my mom would say, Rick, please don't run because you're going to fall and you're going to get hurt. And sure as God made apples, I would fall, and I would skin my elbows and my knees. And as my mom would scoop me up, she would whisper in my ear, "See, God punished you." And that was the concept that I had. That was the concept I had of God. I said, "Why would I want to pray? He will find me, and I'm not going to pray. It's not going to happen." And like my sister and my brother still go to church. Like their experience with church was different from mine. We played tackle football every Sunday morning, and my mom and dad made me go to church, and I would miss most of that game. It was just a choose-up game in the cemetery that we hung out in, and I'm just watching that clock. I'm just watching that clock constantly. I could never be present. And I took that same not being able to be present in AA. I don't know if anybody else is like this. You walk into a meeting, and as soon as the speaker talks, I wish he'd shut up, right? What time is this meeting over? Where are we going after this? Oh, she's cute. We'll need a pair of those sneaks. And I can never be present long enough to hear anything for 6 years in AA. My head would just spin off my shoulders. And if a girl would talk to me or say hi to me, I didn't know. I'm planning the baby's name, right? but she moves on to the speaker, and she's listening to the speaker. But I'm in my head. I'm planning the name of the baby, and what school we're going to go to. But by the end of the meeting, we're divorced, and I'm paying alimony, and I hate her. Right? That's how my head would go in every meeting. I couldn't be there. I was always waiting for something to happen so I could be okay. I was always mad at something that happened so I wasn't okay right here, right now. And the beautiful thing in these steps, it brings us right into the right here, right now. I came in restless, irritable, and discontent. Come in restless, irritable, discontent to present, mindful, and awake. And that's come in isolating, self-reliant, and full of fear to present, mindful, and awake, where I can be right here, right now. I'm not worried about what's going to happen later on. I'm not worried about what's going to happen tomorrow. I wasn't worried about what happened. I am not worried about what happened yesterday or before this meeting. And what a beautiful way to live. And to go through this process, what happens is a reduction of self. Went through steps 4 through 9, and less self, more God, the freer I got. Living moment to moment, accepting what is. And what a beautiful way to live. And that's by no virtue of my own. I've been working with some great AA people in the last few years, and I've been trying to live in the middle of that triangle. And it's very sad that the big book, they took the triangle symbol out of the big book. And with the triangle is our symbol, which means unity, recovery, and service. And and that unity means the fellowship or body, and how I recover that way is by making meetings. And then the service part is spiritual, and how I recover spiritually is by taking other guys through the steps and hearing fifth steps. And the recovery aspect is going through the steps. And if I'm living on all three sides of that triangle, because the triangle is equal in all parts, if I'm living on all three sides of that triangle, I'm right in the middle of that triangle. My decisions are going to be God-conscious and God-directed, and that spiritual malady won't get a hold of me. Because there's an undeniable and eternal reality. When I stop drinking, my spirit gets real sick. I get restless, irritable, discontent. And how that spiritual malady shows itself in my life, how it was explained to me was, for 6 years, this is how I lived. We look like fully grown adults, but I'm childish, grandiose, and very immature. My natural state is one of being fear, anxiety, and depression. I can't stand to be criticized, and I don't like to be praised. I will not suffer. I don't like to suffer, and I will not suffer alone. All right, anybody else relate to that? All my motives are dishonest and self-seeking. And that's how I lived for 6 years. That malady had a hold of me. And I just don't wonder why I had relapse after relapse for 6 years. We had a sponsor and going through these steps. And we did the first three steps in one night. He said that selfishness and self-centeredness was my problem. And not alcohol and drugs. And today I understand that. The third step for me today is my perception has changed in these steps. My third step today is my third step prayer is very simple. I get on my knees in the morning when I wake up and I just say, God, use me. Just use me today. Because I am abundantly clear, perfectly clear of what my purpose is today is to help another alcoholic to recover from this disease. And when I understand my primary purpose and I'm doing my primary purpose, the world gets real small and narrow and there's no spiritual malady. We got down on our hands and knees and we said this third step, prayer together. And that was probably the weirdest experience I ever experienced, to hold another man's hand and to say this third step prayer. And what he explained to me was, Rick, we're making this decision to make your life none of your business no more. And what you want doesn't matter. Are you ready to do that? Sounds good. Right? And that's how I try to live my life today, where what I want doesn't matter. Because you know that feeling we get when we get our own way? Isn't that a pretty cool feeling when we get our own way? Right? I want to go to the Phillies game. No, I want to go to the movies. No. Then we go to the Phillies game. And the best way to get my own way is not to have a way. So that everything goes my way. There's no way. Simple. Right? And I try to apply that principle in all my affairs today. The fourth step. I was so glad the fourth step was coming because I heard so much stuff about the fourth step that I won't see my sponsor for another 6 weeks. And he said, no, Rick, I'm going to go smoke a cigarette. Here's a piece of paper. I want you to write down some resentments and some fears and some people that you've hurt through your sex conduct and people you owe money to. I said, you can't do this. You can't do this. This is against AA. This is against everything I heard in AA. You can't do this. And if there's a number for the AA police, I was going to call them. Because these dudes were going to kill me with these steps. And for the first time, I stood naked before my alcoholism. I saw what kind of son I was. For the first time, I saw what kind of boyfriend I'd been. I saw for the first time what kind of uncle I was and what kind of employee and co-worker I'd been. Reflection, looking in the mirror back at me. And I can see that all my resentments from most of my biggest resentment was my parents, because they wouldn't bail me out of jail. And why they wouldn't bail me out of jail is because I robbed them. Not only did I rob them, I robbed them at knife point. Right? And I stole. I stole their life savings. I stole their peace of mind. I stole their emotional security. I could not believe they wouldn't bail their baby. I got a brother and a sister. They wouldn't bail me out of jail. And I sat in CFCF. I don't know if anybody's ever been in that place. On State Road in Philadelphia. I remember I would call my mom. Eventually, after a month or so, she would pick the phone up. And she would say, well, can you talk to somebody there? I'm like, Mom, I'm not at a rehab. I'm in jail. Right? And the guy and my cellmate does not like white people. And she didn't get it, and she doesn't have to get it. Right? And there's two things I don't do well. I do not detox well, and I don't jail well. I don't know if anybody else does. I don't detox well or go to jail. Well, anywhere I don't want to be for a minute, it's like being in prison. And I don't live that way today. I can be free wherever I'm at. I'm out of my head. I remember this couple guys I was working with. I'm taking through the steps. Said, Rick, you're out of your mind. I said, exactly. Because if I'm in my mind, if I'm up here, I can't experience God. Because God can only be felt right here. And so in order to be out, I got to be out of my head to experience God. Because if I'm in my head, I'm experiencing fear and experiencing resentment. And the next day, these dudes came out of my house, and I had to admit my defensive character to these guys. Not just to one guy, it was a bunch of guys. And I had to look them in the eye and tell them about my parents. I had to look them in the eye and tell them how dishonest and selfish and self-seeking and frightened and inconsiderate I was. Now, on my own, I could do that pretty much. But when I got to admit to another person, look them dead in the eyes, and then go around that room, look these guys in the eye, admit this stuff, it was an experience. It was a freeing experience. And that was where I started to have, like the book says, I began to have the spiritual experience. I remember, I don't know if anybody's from Philadelphia, where my recovery house was around the corner from the Stepping Stones. And after I did the fourth and fifth step, I walked around the Stepping Stones. It's a clubhouse in Philadelphia, and it's a great place to hang out. It's better than reality TV. You don't know what you're going to see, what you're going to find. You don't know what's going to happen in this place. And I walked around to that meeting, and it was a meeting on the fourth step. And I sat there for the first time, and I felt like I no longer felt like a phony member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I fit in. I did that. As we read through the fourth step out of 12 and 12, I felt okay for the first time sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we went through steps 6 and 7. At that moment, we did steps 5, 6, and 7, and 8 at the same sitting, and which was totally against everything I thought that AA could do. Because if you read Bill's story and Dr. Bob and the good old timers, they went through the steps in a matter of days. I didn't know that. I always heard step a year, step a month. If you do a fourth or drink a fifth, right? All that stuff that the biggest lie today was, bring your body and your mind will follow. Right? Because the last thing I want is my thinking mind following me anywhere. Because the main problem centers in our mind. I don't want my mind. It's about having no mind, no thoughts. And then we got on our knees and we said the seven-step prayer. Now, if I would have wrote the seven-step prayer, it would have been, remove these defects of character which stand in the way of my happiness. Right? Because it's all about me being happy. And my friend Danny and Chris and Vic, they said, no, it's not about your happiness. It's about you being useful now. And then I had my 8-step list made for my 4-step. And I had to go back to those parents who I crushed. The only thing my parents ever did wrong was love me. Love me anyhow. I love that word anyhow. And I went back and I had to make amends. And I will never, and my parents are still alive today. They're almost 90. And I went back to these parents. And I went back. I made amends to them. I can never repay them. They will not live long enough for me to repay them. So my dad stopped taking money from me. And I had to go down to these people and say that I was wrong. And for the first time in my life, I said I was wrong. And my dad, I got my dad's attention. He said, what did he say? He said he was wrong. Okay. Now I got his attention. And I said, can you guys forgive me? My mom said, of course we forgive you. We love you anyhow. And I asked my mom, I said, Mom, is there anything else I did to hurt you? And she said, oh, yeah. In 1985, I made my amends. I made my amends in 2005. Right? And in 1985, we had our relatives from Italy come over for Thanksgiving dinner, and you lived in this house, and you never even showed up. And my mom was very sick at this point. And when she said that to me, I watched her get 20 years younger. And my mom was not, my mom has not been sick since. And then when I made my amends to her, they didn't know if she was going to live or die. She was in the hospital. She was going to the gym. She was going to the gym at 84 years old. And she fell off a treadmill and scraped her knees up. And it got infected. And it went into her blood. And they didn't know if she was going to make it or not. And I made my amends to this woman. The only thing she ever did was love me. Because we all know, they say we're not so powerful. Just look at my amends list. You see how I ripped and roared through people's lives. And I went back. I had to go make amends to a lot of people. And it talks about in the step nine, not leading off with the spiritual feature at first. And I believe I was prayed into these rooms by my mother. And she used to pray a lot. She still does. And on the edge of her couch, after I made my amends, was our 24-hour day book. And as I'm walking out, and I'm only a few weeks sober when I made my amends then, because the guilt and remorse was putting the screws to me. And I said, Mom, let me look at this. Let me show you a prayer in this book. And she snatched that book out of my hands, and she says, what's that thing in AA when you don't drink from one day to another day? And I said, sobriety day? And she said, yeah. She said, you come back and talk to me about prayer when you have 84 years sober. Right? Talk about humbling. I was like, wow. And at the time I made my amends, my mom and dad were married 60 years. And they weren't sleeping in the same bed because of me. I would play them off each other. And I go back to make a lot of amends. I'm still, my amends is people from Texas, Florida, California. I've been making my amends for a while. And I know today that's the backbone of my recovery. That is what gives me muscle. Going back and cleaning my amends list up. Step 10, 11, and 12, I do page 84 to the letter today. I always used to hear, Rick, give it to God. How? I remember sitting in the stepping stones, and this little old lady would say, Rick, you don't want it bad enough. Give it to God. How? After about 3 months of hearing that, I wanted to flip the table over on this lady. Right? I didn't know what she was talking about. And today I know it's page 84 of the big book. How I turn something over to God is I watch as can turn. I watch for resentment to crop up. I watch for fear to crop up. I watch for dishonesty to crop up. And when they crop up, I ask God at once to remove them. Right? Then I discuss them with my sponsor immediately. I make amends if I've harmed somebody. Then I resolutely turn my thoughts to somebody I can help. And I'm with guys tonight who I love. Quiet mind and a loving heart. First nine steps gave me that. My head just shut right down. And it says love and tolerance of others is our code. I didn't know what tolerance, I didn't know what love is a rough deal today. Still don't know what that's all about, but tolerance. I thought tolerance was, I am politely pissed off at you, and I'll tell you about it later. That's how you build a brain tumor. I sit in disciplines of steps 10 and 11 every day to the best of my ability, best of my willingness every day. And step 11 is growing through some great AA women and some people not in AA. I've learned how to meditate. You ask me to sit still for 30 seconds, it was almost impossible. I was so wiry, I couldn't sit still. And today I learned how to sit still. I learned how to be still. I learned how today to be still and know there is a God and it's not me. And I do page 86 every night. I read a lot of Emmett Fox. I read a lot of Eckhart Tolle. I read a lot of Anthony DeMello, C.S. Lewis, etc. Along with the big book, not instead of. I was taught in that Alcoholics Anonymous this time around. If I'm not doing page 86, I'm not working step 11. And when I get away from doing page 86 for a period of time, there's a great deal of pain. I don't know if anybody else has experienced that. Step 12. You know, it's... One of my greatest experiences with that stepping stones again. I'm living in this recovery house by myself. So after 4 days, naturally, I think it's my house. Right? We go around the stepping stones. I'm with Chris Brennan and a couple other guys, and we're at this meeting, and that dude walks in. We all know that dude. He walks in. He's filthy, dirty. He has blood running down his arms. He probably hasn't shaved in about 8 to 10 months. And he goes over to the coffee bar and he gets a cup of coffee. And by the time he gets to the table, he spilled the whole coffee because he's shaking so bad. Then he goes back, gets another cup of coffee. Now I'm sitting in a room about as big as this and a table by myself. And this dude sits next to me out of all the people. And I'm looking at my buddies and they're saying, go talk to him. Talk to him. I'm like, you talk to him. Talking to him. And I said, did you see him? And my friend Vic said, no, we saw you when you came back. I said, all right. So I go over there and I told this guy, I started making small talk with this guy. I didn't ask him how he was doing. I just, you know, pretend like I was talking to him. When I walked back to the recovery house that night, I was so full of guilt and remorse over that, because as I went through the first 9 steps, something just came over me where I just didn't feel right about doing that to that dude. And so the next day I went back to the stepping stones. Now I'm looking for that dude. I'm looking for him. I don't see him. Next day, nothing. And 4 or 5 days later, he comes back in. And something inside of me went, yes. And that's not me. That's not me. I'm the guy that would be going through his pockets. And I ask him where he's living at. And he says, what do you think I'm living at? And I asked him if he wanted to come back to the recovery house with me. And he did. And he shaved and showered. And he ate for a few days. And I tried to get him through the steps. And I don't know where he is today. But that guy, if I ever see that guy there, I'm going to give him a bear hug. Because he taught me how to love. I really cared about that guy. And coming out of jail, I was very prejudiced. One of my first sponsees, it's funny how God works, was a black kid with cerebral palsy. And this kid asked me to take him through the steps. And now I had to say yes. Right? That's what AA teaches us, right? And I'm fighting this. And after a couple of hours with this kid, I had to place him in my truck and carry him up to my apartment. Me and the guy I live with downstairs, Vic, he would help me carry him up and we'd put him on my couch. And we would just sit there and open the book up with him and talk with him. And he just made us laugh. He was the happiest guy in the world, and he couldn't even walk. Some days he could walk, other days he couldn't walk. And so he lived in a recovery house. And I don't know if anybody knows where Kensington is. He lived... My buddy Vic owns that one recovery house that I lived in. Now there's 11 of them. And I, for many years, me and Marie ran these 11 recovery houses. And it was an unbelievable experience. So we take this kid, we take Ray back to his recovery house. And on the way back to down on Kensington Avenue. And Vic is very mechanical. I'm not. And he sees one of them hover rounds, one of them motorized scooters. And Vic says, grab that. Put in the back of my truck. I'll put a motor in it for Ray, and be able to get around. So we did that. We fixed up the scooter, and we gave it to him, and it lasted about 30 minutes. He took that scooter straight to Kensington and Somerset. Right? I don't know where he is today, but he taught me how to love. I love that little dude, and I hope he's doing good wherever he's at. You know, there's no way I can grow spiritually or have any kind of spiritual awareness in my heart without another person. And that's just more evidence that we're not put on this earth to be alone. And now my life makes sense. Why am I an alcoholic? Right now it makes sense. I can help that new person as I've been there. You know, there's a book by John Eldridge, if anybody's read it. It talks about where our wound is where our genius is. And in my heart, alcoholism was my wound. And I try to bring that genius, or with my knowledge of that, back to my own community. I believe Kensington, I'm in Kensington a lot. My friend has a lot of recovery houses in the Frankfurt section and in Kensington, and I'm there a lot. And I believe that is the 12-step capital of the world. That Wednesday night meeting, last month, two of our home group members, two guys who came to that meeting, are now dead. One's 31 and one's 29. Would not see our way of life. We have 14 members die. Since me and Marie took it over, Chris Brennan did the meeting, and he handed it over to me and Marie a few years ago. And since me and Marie have been doing that meeting, there has been 14 overdose deaths, and one girl was murdered in Kensington. And people were dying around us helplessly. And I owe Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob a debt of gratitude to go back out there and frantically look for newcomers. Right before Bill Wilson passed away, he wrote a letter to Dr. Young, and Roland Hazard is described on page 26 and 27 of our book, and Bill Wilson had thanked Dr. Young for helping out Roland Hazard, and Dr. Young wrote back, "You know, Bill, I think that alcoholics have a low-level thirst for unity or for a low-level thirst for God." And when I heard Bob D. from Las Vegas read that in a meeting, it struck me that, wow, I've just been drinking from the wrong well. Drink from the well of God, and my thirst for alcohol goes away. I've just been drinking from the wrong well. You know, and through step 11, I've been working with some meditation with some people. And I was posed with a question. The question was, don't figure out what this world needs. And these guys, this guy, very spiritual, not in AA, he said, Rick, ask yourself, don't ask yourself what the world needs. Go ask yourself what lights you up. And just go do that. Because what this world needs is people fully alive. And what lights me up is Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the fellowship. I love going to Stepping Stones. It's better than reality TV. I love the people in it. I love the 12 steps. And I'd like to thank Jeff for inviting me out here tonight to share my experience. I'm not as well versed as some people. My friend Marie, she can speak an hour and 20 minutes on the word rarely. So I am so much more comfortable one-on-one in my apartment with my cat, right, opening up this big book with a new person. I have to thank Jeff. This is a pretty cool thing. This is a far cry from the last stop. I don't know if anybody's been there. This is beautiful stuff up here, guys. Thanks for letting me share. Peace. Thank you.